Kala Falava, and welcome to the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast. I'm Andrew Fa'avali, your host. Every week I'll be chatting with successful Pacific people from across the globe, unpacking their stories and, more importantly, picking out insights, lessons and golden nuggets you can use to live your best life too. Aloha everyone, and welcome to the 12th episode of the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us along the journey. Getting to 12 shows is a massive feat. I think a lot of the podcasts don't actually get past episode 7, and I fully understand that too, because the wheels have nearly fallen off a few times for me. But credit to my team, I should shout them out. My longtime mate Sol Mokhtar of 368 Digital, based in Beirut in Lebanon, and Kyle Dagdag, who helps with post-production and posts and social media, etc. So thanks team for doing the heavy lifting. It's been a great week personally. I had my wife's birthday, so wishing her a happy birthday, Nicola Fa'avali. Thank you so much for all that you do for us and our family. Last week we had my good friend David Solomona, former NRL and UK Super League star, join us for a chat. He's now working off the field with the NRL in the all-important education and wellbeing space. And David offers experience, expertise and post-career pathways. He's very empathetic and he's a great pastoral care leader. So we wish him all the best and thank him for the chat last week. I don't usually preview next week's show here, but man, I'm excited to announce that next week we'll have a Pacific Rhodes Scholar on the show, Alex Fuller. And Alex has just recently finished up as a CEO at Vend. His Rhodes Scholarship was in business and his degree was in accounting and finance. So he's had leadership positions at McKinsey's, Trade Me and Les Mills, amongst others. And he goes broad and deep on many topics, from his family through to his schooling, his move over to Oxford, his leadership positions, and just his thoughts on many different topics such as parenting, identity, being an afakasi, and much, much more. So please tune in. This week we have Karina Lyons, and man, Karina's amazing. Karina's a Samoan Kiwi who's currently the Vice President and Director of Research at the East-West Centre and also a Director at the Pacific Island Development Program, really important entities that are shaping and informing work in the Pacific. Prior to this, she was one of the youngest ambassadors New Zealand has sent out, and she was an ambassador to the Federated States of Micronesia, Republic of Marshall Islands and Republic of Palau, and was also the Consul General to Hawaii. If that wasn't enough, Karina has also represented New Zealand at the UN Security Council as a negotiator and has also worked as a commercial lawyer and worked in higher education for a period of time. A massively inspiring woman who's broken glass ceilings and ankles on her journey through some really pivotal positions, and the best is yet to come. So Karina, welcome and thanks for joining us on the Global Bus Figure Success Podcast.
Thanks Andrew, thanks for having me.
Oh, no worries. It's a pleasure. Man, you've done so much, but I just want to locate where you are right now and what you're doing a little bit. Is it okay if you just give us an explanation as to what you're doing there at the East-West Centre and what the East-West Centre is?
Sure. So the East-West Centre is like a cutting-edge research and capacity building institution. It's been around for 60 years. This year is her 60th anniversary. She's a grand old lady. And she's partially federally funded. So I'm trying to think of a New Zealand or Australian equivalent. It's kind of like a think tank with strong development arm. And I've been at the East-West Centre for just under 12 months.
Okay.
So I'm kind of new. I'm the new kid on the block. And I'm the director of research. So I work really closely with our researchers who they kind of focus on four areas. So climate change and environmental issues generally, and geopolitical and strategic issues. And that's kind of my area of expertise. And we do infectious diseases, including now COVID-19. But I think everybody does COVID-19, whether they want to or not. And then we also do economics, predominantly focused on the demographics of change, which is a fancy way to say we study old people in Asia. And then I'm the head of a crop agency, so that's PIDP, the Pacific Islands Development Program. And so CROP is the Council of Regional Organizations of the Pacific, and it's part of the formal regional part of the Pacific. So New Zealand and Australia and 16 other amazing Pacific countries are part of the Pacific Islands Forum. That's how all the governments interact. And within that architecture or ecosystem, whatever you want to call it, group of countries, there are nine sort of NGOs with different areas of expertise, and they're part of the formal architecture. It's kind of like in the EU, they have different commissions, so different sort of agencies. And so PIDP is one of those, and she's been around for 40 years. And it's kind of an amazing story, PIDP, because it was basically the brainchild of Sir Ratumara, the former Fijian prime minister. He was an incredible strategic mind and a real hustler. So he saw that the way of the future for the Pacific was to take a regional approach. So, you know, we're stronger together. And then he was also part of developing the actual Pacific Islands Forum and the Secretariat. But I think he wrote in his memoirs to kind of counter the dynamics right across the region. He also was keen to have a crop agency, PIDP, set up north of the equator and to involve the Americans, because it was the middle of the Cold War. So I just like that, because I just think, man, his audacity, he just just sort of set the course of the region. And 40 years later, we're all still kind of following that plan, whether we know that history or not. Kind of amazing.
It is, and we've got a few people who we can fall back on as visionaries in our region. I'd love to hear more about how you're rubbing shoulders with many of those. I can't imagine being in a think tank based on the Pacific and the region, especially based at the top of the Pacific Ocean. I want to get there around how you feel and how you got to land there, but can we go back to your backstory? You're on your part Samoan and you're from Auckland?
Yeah, that's right. So I am a Samoan New Zealander. That's how I identify. My name is Karina Rosa Moyava Sengamasina Lyons. And so my mom's Samoan. She is from Sapato Alefanga. Oops, sorry, mom. Kind of south coast, I guess, of Upolu. Yeah. I'm terrible with direction. It's beautiful. There was a movie made there back in the day called Return to Paradise, way back in the day before the Cyclone Orpha wrecked the beach. Yeah. And my dad's family is Irish. So he's one of those white New Zealanders that back in the day we described as Caucasian. And now I think we're comfortable saying that he's like a Kiwi, I guess. But so he'd probably be second generation. So yeah, I'm part of a big group of people who probably are first generation Pacific Islanders in New Zealand. And from Auckland, born and raised, west side, and I went to a church out there, E Pakasa Te Aritu. So I had a very strong Samoan upbringing.
The village.
Very traditional, actually, which is funny because I don't know if I live that life, but I'm definitely grounded in that, the culture and the traditions in that sense. So it kind of frees me up in a way to do whatever I want, because I feel like I did that. And that's the foundation.
Platform. Yeah. Awesome. So West Auckland, where did you go to high school?
I went to Auckland Girls Grammar.
Oh, cool. Back into the city.
Yeah. I think I went there when it was going through like a down patch. Like there was a massive influx of islanders, and I think that's what they described as the down patch. And so that's when I was at back in the early 90s, but I just think that was an incredible experience, right? Because you had all of these young women together, the seething, thriving ambition to something better. So I look fondly actually on that time. I was super geeky though, maybe that's why I describe it like that. Like it was an opportunity for me to be exposed to stuff that I just, you know, that totally blew my mind.
So you obviously didn't just land at these roles where you're in international forums and stuff like that. What was kind of fostering your leadership abilities and your boldness and your courage to be able to go and eventually at a really young age overseas as a diplomat for New Zealand?
Are you the oldest? That's a super flattering description. Boldness, I'll take though. I'll definitely, and I feel like I got that from my family. Do you know that whole kind of story about new immigrants, whether it's in Samoa or in America, you're talking about the Irish or the Italians and there's Chinese Americans, a really strong tradition for your parents to pursue a professional career, like being a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I started, I think. I started my career as a corporate solicitor, as like a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. I say the words like they're swear words. I really... It's not for me. And I hated it every moment. I used to get super stressed on Sunday evenings, like my stomach would hurt because I hated it so much. But I'm really grateful for that experience because it was 2 years of having my work torn apart and, you know, really high standards and dealing with a lot of self-doubt about whether I was smart, whether I could practice in the law, all of that kind of stuff. And I kind of did one of two things for me. Like, I set the tone in terms of professional standards, a baptism of fire, so the standards were high. And then secondly, I figured maybe there's something more or something else or something different. And I hadn't ever really felt that before. I was just kind of on that path and I'd just gone right through the system to get to become a fancy lawyer at a big multinational firm. It was the kind of place where, you know, there were like two Pacific Island lawyers and the rest of my friends were all in the mailroom, you know, like it was, yeah. And then actually my cousin later worked in that mailroom. And so I think on reflection, like, it was just really alienating. And I couldn't recognize that at the time. I didn't know. I just thought it was me and I needed to do something else. And so then I did. And I guess I kind of pinged around. Like, I really didn't have a career plan.
Really?
I really didn't. I just was so, when I quit being a lawyer, I was so lost. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I felt so much pressure to make my parents proud, to be successful, because I'd had this amazing job. And then I quit, you know, like I worked long enough to pay for profs, so I didn't have to pay that back. But I remember if you stayed a third year, they had a really high attrition rate. And if you stayed a third year, then you got a $10,000 bonus in the hand. And I didn't stay.
Really?
I know. Yeah.
But it speaks volumes as to how it was kind of conflicting for you, right?
Yeah. I was like, surely not. And so that was my first kind of existential crisis and I really enjoyed it and I'm glad. And then I spent the next 6 to 8 months being unemployed, just being just super stressed and lost and you know, thinking like, oh, how am I going to pay all the bills? And I'm the oldest child. I'm the oldest daughter. And yeah, there was a lot of like shame there. And so now that I'm old and I look back on that time, it was really character forming. You know, it's like that whole like what doesn't kill you make you stronger, which is both a pop song and Nietzsche and Ariana Grande or whatever. I don't know. It's a wisdom that keeps on giving. So, so then from there, I did a whole bunch of stuff, including working at the law school at the University of Auckland. I worked briefly at AUT. I worked at an education trust in South Auckland for a couple of years or a few years. I lose track of time. And that was, that really taught me gratitude, I think. It really showed me how much I had in my life already. Like there was, you know, we're quite a traditional family, which meant like 13 people in 2 bedrooms, not that much stuff. And I think I felt consciously poor until I started working in South Auckland. And then I realized, you know, how absolutely lucky and blessed I was to have two parents who were so invested in my education and that of all of my, you know, it was really strict and then we didn't have anything, blah, blah, blah. But that's like, you know, nothing compared to having the kind of family that are really invested in keeping you safe and making sure that you're educated. And yeah. And so then that kind of spurred me on to do the sort of things that you do, Andrew, which is, you know, think hard about, you know, how to make a difference in every single role, every single sort of activity. You know, I firmly believe that representation matters. And so it kind of gave me the courage to embrace my geekiness. And then start to think hard about, you know, channeling that. And so I found my way to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which is the New Zealand Foreign Service or the equivalent to the US State Department or the equivalent to Australia's DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And so that's where you go to be a diplomat. And I'd never even heard about it before.
Yeah.
Before I applied.
And then you're one of the youngest to ever be sent overseas. It's amazing.
Yeah, I was a young ambassador. That's right. No, I mean, we send people out quite young in different positions in embassies and high commissions. But
ambassador.
Yeah, I was appointed ambassador when I was 37, which is pretty young as these things go. I mean, no one ever thought I was the ambassador when I when I showed up, you know, except for the security and the staff, and sort of people calling me Excellency and stuff like that. But it was pretty tricky in the Pacific because, you know, like it's the intersection of culture and protocol and expectations, identity politics, you know, like particularly in the North, where for a long time the politicians were men, which is the case still mostly everywhere in the world, not just the Pacific. But in the Pacific, it's, I think there was a time, maybe a few years ago, I was checking these stats. There were only six countries in the entire world that didn't have any women in their parliament or in their legislature. And three of those countries were in the Pacific.
Really?
Really. We could do better.
Disappointing. Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, not most Pacific nations have not had a female leader.
When you think about it.
You know? Yep. Australia's had one. New Zealand's had three. The Marshall Islands has had one. And I think that's it.
Are we actually, as a region, doing anything about that quite proactively?
I think so. And at all levels, at the grassroots level and at the governance level. At the governance level, things move much slower. And, you know, some of the things that attracted me to the East West Centre and PIDP, where I am now, was the opportunity to do this mahi, to do this work in the region.
Yeah.
So there are leadership courses. There are, I mean, there's heaps right across the different industries. But what I was going to say is, you know, I think where a big difference can be made is in churches, you know, like which remain right throughout the Pacific, like a sort of a key power structure for disseminating culture, social control, and, you know, just really, yeah, shaping the way that our people collectively tend to see the world. And you think about that, how many female leaders are there? You know, there's quite traditional roles, like the women, if they're going to be the Sunday school teachers, right? not that many pastors or whatever. I mean, that's, I don't mean to pick on the church. It's just sort of, I just hadn't thought about that stuff in a while. And one of the great things that I've seen is that when there are sort of development programs, grassroots programs focusing on enhancing opportunities for women and honing their skills, they tend to be incredibly successful. You know, so the talent's there. You know, like you and I both know this, Andrew, right? The talent's always there. It's often about access, opportunities, time, and just resources.
Yeah, so they're in Hawaii. How is it for you then being the VP of the East West Centre and also the Director of Research?
Yeah, it's an adjustment. I mean, I just retired from the New Zealand Foreign Service, so this is the first time in, gosh, over a decade longer, where I haven't had a formal kind of tether or rope pulling me back home to the Pacific. And it was a big call to work in America, basically, you know, on issues that affect our region in the Pacific. And I did it because of the chance to actually, you know, upskill or educate or share with my American colleagues different Pacific perspectives. Nice. You know, all of the U.S. ambassadors that get appointed to anywhere throughout the Asia-Pacific region come through the East West Center to be briefed. And so if you get the opportunity to talk to a U.S. ambassador, who's been, they're all been approved by Senate, and it's a chance to shape their perspective about our region, our issues, our people, and I think that was just too good an opportunity to pass up.
Yeah.
I worked very closely with the military, the U.S. military out here. One of my jobs was to be New Zealand's envoy to U.S. Pacific Command. You know, in New Zealand, our military is really hardworking but extremely small. Like, I didn't know anything about it, really, in my life as a regular person eating KFC and trying not to. here, you know, this is one of the biggest unified commands in all of the U.S., architecture. It's where the U.S. Navy that monitors the Pacific is based, and their area of responsibility, so the commander here has kind of an overview of U.S. military actions across all branches, Navy, Army, blah, 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 and over an area that covers something like 55% of the Earth's surface.
Mm-hmm.
It is massive. Their budget is, I can't remember at the moment, because the economy has fluctuated so much, but their budget used to be around 10 times New Zealand's GDP. No, that's not right. Maybe like two or three times. My bad.
Yeah,
but I was thinking of a different country, but yeah, I mean, like, massive. So their influence and their influence in Washington is unmeasurable. And so then you get the opportunity to talk to them about, you know, what Pacific people want and, you know, how to interact with us as security partners, as allies. And, you know, like it or not, you know, there is a big sort of a great power rivalry at the moment between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
And the Pacific is one of those arenas. And so people look at what China has done militarizing islands in the South China Sea.
Yeah.
And there was an international court case about that a few years ago, decided by the Permanent Court of Arbitration, that decided sort of definitively in favor of the claimants, in favor of the Philippines, whatever. And New Zealand and all of the Pacific have a position on all of that stuff. But people look at that and think, huh, like what's next? Mm. You look at, you know, will it be the Pacific? And then in the Pacific region, of course, these issues are always more complicated because there are most nations in the Pacific region have an important and legitimate partnership with China. Mm. You know, we're trade partners. We're good friends with Chinese people, all of that stuff. And so having Pacific voices at the American end, just to round out the nature of the discussion, yeah, that's kind of why I ended up here for the work. I'm a geek. And the weather is amazing in the Pukie Rocks.
So what do you think is the main opportunity for the Pacific in between America and China? And what is kind of the focus of your work? What are you trying to platform in terms of getting our voice or our seat at that table, you know, as a point of influence?
I believe that there is a role for regionalism in the Pacific. And I say that because regionalism is quite new. And, you know, what is that? In practice, it just means that we come together as a collection of nations to advance our collective interests.
Yeah.
So we already do that in New York and at the UN. And that's why I think it can work so well, because I've seen it like the SIDS, the Small Island Developing States, you know, the Pacific negotiators at that level are absolutely kick-ass. And, you know, they are responsible for making sure that in the Sustainable Development Goals, which dictates a lot of where development dollars go, and a lot of development dollars are relied upon in our region, they dictated that push for an SDG to be about oceans. Oh. And that might seem like, oh, that's a no-brainer, but, you know, most of the big powers are big land masses.
Land masses, yeah.
Yeah, whereas we're all, you know, we're rich in ocean. I mean, the Pacific region, ocean covers 98% of it.
Yeah.
So, So it's kind of amazing. And we want to make sure that from an environmental perspective, our homes are protected. And then from an economic perspective, we're getting ours. And some, you know, like it's a key resource for us.
Mm.
And, you know, history has dictated that other countries come into our region and reap the benefit of the licenses. They fish all the fish. Yeah. They've got all of the value-add technology and infrastructure. And I feel like we're becoming, you know, we need to attract foreign investment, and so that we can then become the owners of all of that value-added business.
So the diaspora obviously have a big part to play in that, because a lot of them are in those countries from which those outsiders are coming and reaping the benefits. Can the diaspora play a part in that, especially in the private sector? Maybe they'll go in with the same skills, but it's Pacific, and we know that enterprises or social enterprise, or mostly social enterprise for us anyway. So how can we contribute being located out of our motherlands?
I think the diaspora is key, actually. I think what's important is that the diaspora remembers that the Pacific is an extremely diverse place, and you don't have to do one thing or be a certain way in order to make a contribution. And part of that is just, I think, just be really good at what it is that you do. I said something quite controversial recently. I was rolled out to sort of give a leadership spiel to young people. And I said, this crazy thing, like, don't follow your passion, you know, screw that. Just work on developing skills, get really good at something.
Yeah.
And then do that thing that you're good at in a way that benefits your family, your community, our people, our region.
Yeah.
And that's really, I mean, that's kind of where I think, you know, in business in particular, you know, I would love to see much more investment in Pacific businesses, which traditionally are a small and medium size. And I think that that's awesome. We have to start where we are. And, you know, the size of your company doesn't dictate the possibility of you being a billionaire. I was looking at Australia's newest, oh no, she's not new. She's young. She's like that 32-year-old woman who's like the third richest person in Australia.
Is that a Canva lady?
I think, yeah, her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just like, that could be a Pacific Islander.
Exactly. Why couldn't it be? There's no reason.
There's no reason. It's a platform. There's no reason.
Exactly. So
honestly, it was the first thing I thought when I saw her. And so, I mean, so that's kind of what I mean, like wherever you are. And then then the only other thing I'll say is be mindful about our capabilities so that you know what you're dealing with when you're doing your bit to expand them or to enhance them. You know, be realistic about that. So in the Pacific, there are still countries that are like least developed countries, so they get a lot of development funding. And I'm always like, doesn't matter where it comes from, it's what you do with it, right? Doesn't matter what your degree is, what you do with it.
That's right.
But, you know, don't try to be, you know, an internet sensation or a Mongol if you're living in somewhere where there's really low internet penetration. You know, like at the moment, something like 17% of the Kiribati population is on the internet. Similar in Solomon Islands, actually, and Papua New Guinea. Really large populations, and so they're kind of big macro issues, but I also think it's important for Pacific Islanders to understand them, like who's negotiating for us with the really big multinationals to build another spur off the Southern Cross cable. You know, like that's like hundreds of millions of dollars. The World Bank just agreed to do a project with the Federated States of Micronesia, and it's called Digital FSM. It's basically building a cable, costs around $300 million. It's going to be transformative, you know, in amazing ways and other ways that people will have concerns about. But it's just like, who's doing those deals?
So why aren't we doing those deals? What is it? Is it the fact that the advertisements aren't in front of us? Is it the fact that we don't have the networks? Or is it also just us not looking? What's behind us not being at that table? Because I think there were other times before where maybe we weren't prepared for it. But I don't even believe that. I think we're really prepared. We're just not at the table still. And I want to know why.
Yeah, it depends because some of us are at the table, right? Like in the case of FSM, that was a deal with between the FSM government and the World Bank, and a key partner was the U.S. government. That's all like embassies. You know, this is all you can read it on you can Google it. It's it's not classified.
G14.
If you're listening, New Zealand government. Yeah, I think being at the table is key. And it's figuring out a realistic pathway, which is why I say, like, you know, just get good at things. You know, sure, if your passion is policy, fine. But I don't know if I've really met anybody. I didn't grow up with anybody who was like, oh, yeah, policy is my passion. And now I can say policy is my passion. But I just kind of fell into it. And I definitely... I think being at the table is about figuring out what you're good at, but also really hard work. I think that there's this myth amongst our youth, and it's perpetuated by global culture, where you have to be like Harry Potter or something. Like, you know, one day you're just a normal person doing the chores, you're doing your fails, whatever, and the next day you suddenly get identified as this amazing wizard. And my journey was just not like that. It was filled with trial and error and doubt. And I've pretty much never been the most talented person that I'm working with. But what I do have, what has ensured that I got to, like, you know, big tables, like the UN Security Council and, you know, sitting with, I don't know, President Putin, whatever. Wow. You know, what I do have is a really strong work ethic. And, you know, I'm okay with not being like, the most talented, like, you know, you've got to have some talent. There's this real disconnect between people being talented and just being a hard worker. Being a hard worker will get you far. You know, when I think, why aren't we at the table? I always like to start with like taking responsibility. So there is an element of that. And then of course there's the actual formal and social, you know, obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. you know, people aren't amping for us to be at the table. Like, it's not an easy road.
So there's an intrinsic thing about hard work, and, you know, that's what I was really alluding to at the start. You've sat at the table of these massive forum, you know, the UN and international bodies like that. And then I was really amazed at how did you get the courage to get there. But you're saying it wasn't that, oh, boom, there was just a bit of luck at one point in time. It was just consistent hard work. I also heard that you said you were at the mergers and acquisitions law firm, and then you had that conflict and tension, and that was kind of a big learning curve for you. You know, I think a lot of people listening are on that journey, and maybe sometimes we keep our eyes on the ground and don't see that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there. When they're feeling that conflict and tension, like that Sunday-itis that really cuts deep in the stomach, how did you manage and negotiate that? And what did it take for you to say, okay, I'm out, even though the $10,000 carrot was there? There are many carrots. Being in that firm made your parents proud. It made all our parents proud to go through law school. I'm also a person who did a whole law degree for my parents. But, how did you navigate and negotiate that feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a lifelong journey of getting more and more comfortable with failure and recognizing that as a really rich and important and powerful learning opportunity. And I think for me, the biggest thing that helped me navigate was my sense of curiosity, you know, like this recognition that, every Sunday night I have to do a stress poo because I'm so stressed out. And realizing that, there's a pattern here. Oh, like I have these feelings and they're really negative.
Yeah.
And then being curious about that, wanting to explore that, you know, I'm actually doing this for my parents and I feel a lot of resentment around that. Maybe that's not good for my relationship with my parents. And maybe that's going to take me 10 years or, or 20 to reconcile, you know, to really reckon with that and then work my way through it. So I look back on that time when I quit the firm, I would have been 23, 24. And then I had like cervical cancer. Wow. Which was the good excuse because it was an opportunity to leave and they kept the job open and I didn't go back. And, what I remember from that time was the crushing sense of failure. And then there was the curiosity around that. And then there was sort of the work ethic, you know, just keep going. And I think that was the most courageous thing that I did, was just to keep getting up in the morning, even though I didn't have a job. And I felt like the crushing shame of disappointing my parents was just to keep going and to, you know, people say, oh, I really believe in myself and I just knew that I could. And I don't remember thinking that, but I think I just kept going anyway. And, you know, that same determination to keep going has evolved into something that I have much more control over now. And so, you know, when I experience failure, I feel the crushing shame of it. And then I have this little mantra in my head, just like, oh, great, another learning opportunity. You know, like, you can do this. You can, these are just feelings. It's like your feeling of disappointment and shame is all just perception. And you can choose not to feel that way. Wow. And when I don't feel that way, it really enables me to keep going. And then I can fall back on the skills that I've developed over 20 years of being a hustler.
A hustler, all right. So I'm interested.
Yeah.
You said, you know, you don't recall having that. Yeah, I just believe in myself. But do you have that now? Do you believe?
Yeah, I do. And it's a practice. You know, like gratitude is a practice. Kindness is a practice. Mm. Positive self-talk is a practice. Like, I think I do.
Do you consciously practice? Is it a mantra? Is it a thing you get up and do? You know how Tony Robbins gets up and goes through a process, or is it not so formal? It's just something that has come through experience.
Yeah, it's not so formal. I wish I practiced it. I think that would be really positive. So if you're out there listening and thinking about, you know, it's like a meditation, I guess, that seems to be a really useful thing that other people in my family do, you know, like therapy and meditation, all of these mechanisms that help you to explore your feelings in an attempt to control them. Because you think about how powerful your feelings are and how much they dictate the way that your life will turn out in your head. You know, there's these external material factors, but really, you know, when I look at being a negotiator on the UN Security Council, what was incredible to me now is not what I was doing at the time, but the fact that, yeah, like you say, like I had the the audacity to think that I could get there. You know what I mean? Like, there, you can be sure there were no other islanders there, but there will be, and there will be a time when Samoa or Tonga or PNG will be on the council. And you just got to, you got to track back and remind yourself that you can do things.
So it's audacious. It's audacious, but really it should be normalized. We're amazing people from an amazing part of the world, and we have amazing ancestors and forebears, and I think that we are set up for this, but maybe sometimes our feelings and our thoughts aren't supporting us to go into those big stages. So congratulations and thanks for getting to the table and being someone that I know who sat at those tables. We know research shows, but even just our experience, that when we've spoken or seen or heard from someone like this who has gone to those places, our self-belief just immediately kind of vicariously follows through with yours. So it's just amazing. When you were walking into those rooms, how did you prepare for those negotiations? Negotiations at any level, even wife and husband or child and parent, is, you know, not the easiest of processes. How did you prepare for those negotiations at a global level?
Yeah, I took it really seriously, as you'd expect, and I studied like it was your final exam. You know, when people say you've got to put in the work, that's just 100% true. Mm. And, you know, when I haven't prepared as much as I would like, I do tend to regret it. I don't think there is such a thing as sort of preparation, really. And, you know, I was in good company preparing for those negotiations, because New Zealand is only ever on the Security Council every 25 to 35 years.
What?
So as a nation, we were preparing. So, I mean, that's why it was such an incredible experience, because it's once in a career, once in a lifetime experience. And so we were all feeling that, like the little guy next to, you know, the US, the, you know, China, Russia, the UK, who else was on the council with us? Spain. It's hard to remember now. And I was supposed to be just transitioning the team. I was the strategist during the campaign, and then I was trying to move back because I was exhausted. It was like a four years of my life, and I didn't actually want to stay on the council the whole time. So I was only on for a short amount of time. I had a different job to go back to because the New Zealand Foreign Service is rotational. And this is the thing, like, they gave me the option of staying on the council to be a negotiator. I declined because I was trying to listen to myself. You know, it's like, it was so tempting for my ego. But I also was trying to, you know, keep moving forward. And I'd already been in New York for several years by then. But one big negotiation that I did do before I moved back and worked for a foreign minister was the time that Russia annexed the Crimea. I don't know if you remember, just, you know, randomly in 2014, 2015, it was across that time, like not randomly, but, you know, Russia just decided it would take the Crimea back. And it was what we all considered to be an illegal annexation. And that was super intense. And it was just, it represented weeks of sleepless nights as I was basically studying history, studying UN resolutions, Security Council resolutions, talking a lot with my Ukrainian colleagues, you know, trying to think creatively, trying not to be intimidated by the fact that all of these big countries have their ways of doing things, and trying to think, like, I'm from New Zealand, we're from the Pacific, how do we deal with things? Oh, we just, like, have a bit of a Kōrero or have a bit of a Tylenol, and maybe we should do that. And so there was, like, a small group of us, the Americans and the Ukrainians and the French, and we would meet at the Ukrainian embassy and just try to, like, nut through, like, workshop stuff. You know, like, you think it's, like, this really, like, high level, but at the end of the day, you know, we're all just people. And I remember actively telling myself, just, you know, they're just people. They put on their undies, you know, one leg at a time.
They don't hop through them, two legs.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't know. Like, that's a higher risk maneuver, you know, like.
And, it's true, though. That you think there's something different.
I mean, I've taken that through to every aspect of my life, you know, just preparation. Listen, you know, this whole thing, like, there's a real kind of bravado around winging it, and I'm not into it. I just, like, honestly, hard work, it's one of those things, like my mom always said, and I didn't start out being the super geeky studying person, I don't think. And I've definitely developed it the more senior I've become, sort of the more success I've had, the more I've understood the value of preparation.
Man, so many knowledge bombs here on so many levels, leadership and career pathways. The beauty of it is that, you know, you're really self-aware, you're curious, you're hardworking, you really value preparation. Those things are free, and that's, you know, this is a podcast about success and really the picture I wanted to paint because I love hanging around with successful people is it's actually those free things that really got them there. Yeah, there's a lot of blessings and talent, but like you said, hard work is something that everyone can do and you have to have some talent. But then what you've also said is dig deep into something that might not be your passion, but just acquire skills that you can double down on so that you can succeed in that field. I know that we've booked an hour for this and I really appreciate your time. I might just, if I can, just finish off on some of the lighter questions or, you know, I just want to know what's your own personal career highlight? Because from the outside, we're like, everything's a highlight to us. We're proud of you. We're, you know, we're cheering you on. But what's your own personal career highlight?
Yeah, I think I have two. The first one is the first time I got to represent New Zealand at Anzac Day. So I was ambassador to those countries. But I was, I did a ceremony here in Hawaii, and a lot of the high-ranking military were here. There's something like 11 four-star generals or admirals in the entire U.S. military, and four of them are based here.
Really?
Yeah, it's really, this is the thing, man. If you want to see Ospreys, you want to see like an aircraft carrier, come on out to Hawaii and get your tour. And I got to, you know, stand up in front of thousands of people and as the New Zealand ambassador give a speech. So I told the story of my Papa, my father's father, and his experience in World War II.
Oh, wow.
And then just trying to draw that together, like draw those lessons. Like I think of him as a very, you know, think of courage and boldness, you know, like a 21-year-old, 22-year-old man from New Zealand, never been anywhere. And then going out to Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and getting captured in a cave and being a prisoner of war and Switzerland, and then the Italians turned and all of those Anzacs had to walk to safety from Switzerland, from Italy to Switzerland, like literally walk. And they walked right through the soles of their boots. And I reflected on that in terms of lessons for those of us today, both in terms of, you know, why peace is so important and the sacrifices that were made. And then also the trauma that comes from those experiences from war and how that affects us all. And we all have to keep doing that work together to reconcile that. And just being able to say that and tell my grandfather's story. And beautiful. I like wrote the speech and then sent it to my father. And even that's going to make me cry because it's a big deal. Yeah. And then the other highlight would be when I worked at the law school at the University of Auckland. And it was the first kind of big job that I'd had since I quit the firm and was, you know, my confidence was really low because I had been unemployed for so long. And it was me just trying to remind myself or tell myself or convince myself that I could really do it. And so it was a program about enhancing or a remedial program. And that was designed to address the fact that the Pacific Island students were dominating the fail stats or the C grades. And I took a piece of research from the Faculty of Education, which showed me that there was no correlation between entry grades into university and then your likelihood or propensity to graduate or to get into honors. And so what I took from that was what I was trying to believe myself, that I, as a Pacific woman, that we as Pacific people are just as talented and have just as much potential, even like, and are incredibly resilient. And maybe we don't have the skills, or maybe we didn't have anybody who supported us in terms of understanding the system, because often the system we don't understand because we're the first person in our family to go and nobody tells us the tricks that everybody else who has access seems to know.
Mm.
So I ran a program called the Honors Club. It was called PASS, Pacifica Academic Assistance, whatever. And the whole point was, the starting point was, we're good enough. We're incredibly talented. We're incredibly resilient. And this is an opportunity to learn some of the study skills that we should have picked up on the way, but for whatever reason, no judgment, we didn't. And so, and the kind of the measure was, you know, how to get, how many Pacific Island students were getting into the honors program, LLB honors. There's no kind of affirmative action program. It's just a straight GPA. And I ran that for about 4 years. And when we did the stats at the end, the analytics, we had increased the number of Pacific Island students in LLB honors by 600% every year for the duration of the program. which is, that was all them. It's all their talent, all their hard work. And to this day, I still get my jollies when out of nowhere, somebody will contact me looking either for a job or a hookup. They remember me from that time and they remember that, you know, I've been pro Pasifika, incredibly consciously biased in favor of Pacific peoples since way back. And that, you know, if you get my email address or you see me on LinkedIn, then you can hit me up and I will make the time. Awesome. Because I know that it works. And then I just keep getting that reward come back tenfold when they get in touch with me. And they're, you know, one student was just recently, and she's a Fulbright at Cornell doing economics. Like, she's freaking unicorn, man. Like, this Tongan woman. Like, I was like, oh my God, you're so scary. I can barely add the tip, 20% tip. Yeah. So that was definitely a highlight for me, just being part of that time. And then learning that lesson myself, that it's true, we're good enough. That's but right. Maybe we need the skills. So,
and you know what's beautiful about that from my perspective is that the system, like you say, the system, we just might have not had experience in navigating the system. So what you've done is created a system to make us successful within that system. And it wasn't
demystifying it, you know?
Yeah, and it wasn't, it's not anything on us. It's just the navigation of the system. And so now you're seeing the fruits of it. And I think the fruits are going to cascade into generations because they got LLB honors. And so, yeah, thank you so much for setting that up. Lastly, I've got two here, but what advice would you give your 20-year-old self? I'll probably go on that one because I was going to say, what advice would you give on others? But the 20-year-old self, kind of we can like personalize it, and it sounds like it comes out of experience.
Yeah, I'd say be kind to yourself, girlfriend. Yeah, just chill out. That's normal. And do what you think is right. Pursue those stoic virtues if you're Christian, or if you're interested in stoic philosophy or Buddhism or rationality or anything. Like, if you pursue courage and wisdom and temperance, things like that, those sorts of principles. Temperance is, that's a really old-fashioned word, moderation. If you pursue moderation, then, you know, the chances are you will succeed at setting good goals for your life and achieving them. And for me, looking back when I was 20, I think I was really worried about making my parents proud and being a success. And I feel like I've achieved both of those because I've got great relationships with all of my family. Like, I genuinely like them as people. That's a thing.
That's a thing. Yeah.
I want to hang out with them. And part, you know, that takes hard work, honesty, working through the issues, the trauma of being poor, all of that stuff. So I would tell my 20-year-old self, you know, be kind to yourself, hang in there. It's all worth it. And don't get distracted by material goals. That's not what's going to fulfill you.
Wow. Thanks so much, Karina. Karina, I've got heaps more to chat to you about, but I respect your time and I really appreciate that the fact that you've shared your story and a bit of your career pathway with us. Man, what an inspiration. What a start to the day. It's like 8 o'clock here in Brisbane.
Oh, wow.
And I just... Man, I'm ready for the day now. I really thank you and congratulate you on behalf of me, but I reckon on behalf of our community for all the stuff that you've achieved for yourself, but also for us. So, yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you, Andrew. I just want to say while we're still recording, thank you for creating this vehicle and for being somebody who walks the walk yourself. You know, obviously, we don't know each other super well, but I love that you are the kind of person who will reach out across the divide in an attempt to share stories to encourage all of us to keep going. And so I found this very energizing myself. So thank you for that.
Wow. So grateful that Karina's taken time out of her busy schedule to chat to us. She was very accommodating and also very open and honest about the peaks and troughs of her career. What I really love is that she talks about how talent counts, but hard work, preparation, and curiosity counts even more. And, you know, if someone with so much success or as much success as Karina says that those things or those traits count, then I think it would be wise for us to listen. She's spoken in front of thousands, she's negotiated at the UN, and she's now leading a pivotal organization such as the East-West Center. And we really need to heed her advice and implement it in our own lives if we want to emulate the success that she's had and sit at similar tables. I really love her down-to-earth nature, and I love how she mixes up high-level topics with grounded chat and a warm sense of humour. And so I just feel really lucky to have had that chat and have drawn inspiration from this woman, and I wish her all the best. The best is yet to come for her. Like I said at the top, next week we have Alex Fuller, Pacific Road Scholar and a leader in business, and I'm really excited to bring you his story. I know you're going to get so much out of it, so make sure you tune in. In the meantime, though, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. It means a lot to us to try to get up those ratings. But otherwise, take care. In the meantime, have a great week, and God bless. We'll catch you next week.